Hello, I'm Mark Gerson, and I'm the rabbi's husband. And on this show, I hope to demonstrate just how exhilarating, accessible, and simply helpful the Torah is to everyone. And that, as you'll see, is going to be a particularly easy task today, given my guest and the subject. I am delighted today to be joined by Rabbi Mark Wilds, the founder and the leader of Manhattan Jewish Experience, which has become the most important institution in Jewish life for people in their 20s and 30s in Manhattan. And Rabbi Wilds and Manhattan Jewish Experience is by this point legendary around here in New York for the number of marriages that have been created by people who have met through MJE, as well as the quality and the quantity of Torah learning and Jewish practice where these couples meet and where all kinds of other Jewish activities take place. And it's just amazing. I remember nearly the beginning of MJE, probably 5 years after, and now how it's grown and has been such an incredible institution in New York City and a model for the country and for the Jewish world generally and globally. And we're here today with Rabbi Wilds to discuss his magnificent book, The 40-Day Challenge, Daily Jewish Insights to Prepare for the High Holidays. Rabbi Wilds, welcome to The Rabbi's Husband.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, Mark, and I really am grateful for our friendship. We've known each other many, many years, and I love studying and having conversations with you about the Torah.
Absolutely, and I love this book, and so I'm so excited to discuss it and to learn even more from you based on it today. So it's the 40-day challenge. It's based on how do we prepare for the high holidays. So before we get into the book, why don't you just tell us, what is Rosh Hashanah? What is Yom Kippur? What is the purpose of them? And what should be our relationship with them?
So that's a great question. And I wish more of us actually talked about it, because so many Jews engage in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and come to high holiday services without really knowing the purpose and the function. Purpose really is to develop ourselves into the best version of ourselves by having these moments with God, with the community, and having sort of like a yearly check-in. Every day we're trying to live up to our potential. We're trying to realize whatever goals and aspirations we have. But once a year, we ask ourselves a very simple question. What are our goals and our aspirations? What am I shooting for? I mean, we do this in our businesses. We do this in every aspect of our lives. If you don't have a plan, if you don't have a goal and aspiration, then how do you know whether you're living a successful life? What are you measuring it against? So I think that's one of the most fundamental aspects. It's the new year. What are we shooting for in the new year? What are our goals and aspirations? And then we could spend the rest of the year trying to achieve those dreams. But what are the dreams? And I think that's a fundamental question we need to ask ourselves on the high holidays.
In the Bible, of course, Rosh Hashanah is not the new year. In fact, Rosh Hashanah is not even in the Torah. It's the day of shouting or the day of loud blasts. And what we still have in practice from them is the shofar.
Yeah, the Torah calls the Rosh Hashanah, as you correctly pointed out, a Yom Teruah, a day of blasting. And the shofar takes on a lot of significance because it is supposed to be, Maimonides writes, a wake-up call. It's supposed to sort of wake up, like, you know, we're starting a new era in our life. What are we here for? Why do we exist?
Right. And so what's the difference in meaning and approach between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are actually very different. The point of Rosh Hashanah is to declare God as king, to acknowledge that we are subjects of a creator and that there is like a system in the world, that we're here for a certain purpose. Yom Kippur is for atonement. Yom Kippur is to get our sins forgiven. Rosh Hashanah isn't. In fact, if you look at the liturgy, or the prayers that we say in Rosh Hashanah, there's almost no reference to forgiveness for sins. I'll do better in the coming year. That's all Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah, you have to sort of set up the relationship, because the idea of asking God for forgiveness without first acknowledging who God is, who we are in relation to God, what are our aspirations, Rosh Hashanah is really step one. Set up the plan, who we are, who God is, why are we here? Very fundamental, basic concepts of human existence. Once we have that down, we can then move on to say, wait, how am I doing? I haven't been doing so great in this area. I could use a little improvement in that area. And that's where the forgiveness comes in on Yom Kippur.
So Rosh Hashanah is preparation for Yom Kippur.
100%.
So let's talk about preparation, because your book is the 40-day challenge. The challenge is all about preparation. Now, you quoted Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik in the book by saying that all holiness involves preparation.
Yeah.
And your application of that truth to Rosh Hashanah is so profound, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because what could we possibly get out of what we call the high holidays by just walking in not having given it any serious contemplation at all, or maybe no contemplation whatsoever.
Yeah, it's incredible how much we expect from an experience that we do almost zero preparation for. I mean, you know, we wouldn't just show up and like, oh, I'll wing my proposal. Everybody thinks a little. They think about, you know, where am I going to take her? Where am I going to ask? Same thing with an important business meeting. You don't just show up and expect it to do its magic. They need some sort of preparation. I talk about Tom Brady in the introduction.
Right.
You know, who's an incredible football player, because Tom Brady followed a very strict regimen of preparation. He over-prepared, and he's a great model for what I think we should be doing at least some of before we hit the high holidays, and that is doing a little preparation. That's why I wrote the book. The idea is that every single day from Rosh Chodesh Elul, which is the beginning of the holiest month on the Jewish calendar, Elul, we read a little excerpt, just 5 minutes, answer a personal challenge question to personalize the teaching, and then by the time Yom Kippur hits, I believe just through these 40 teachings, we can be more prepared.
Prepared for what?
We can be prepared, number one, to stand before our maker, our creator. That's not something we take lightly. You don't just show up at the palace.
That's right.
You got to get yourself into a certain spiritual state.
That's right. I mean, if you're going to a meeting at the White House to meet with the president, you wouldn't just show up and then when you get there, think about what you might want to talk about.
You know, I'm a big Conan O'Brien fan. I don't know. I got into Conan a lot during COVID. It looks as though a lot of these guys that he has on don't prepare, but all of his guests prepare. Conan
sure
prepares. He's got a team of writers. He himself was a writer. That's how we got into this. I mean, all of these shows, they all look like they're just happening in real time. They're not just happening. They're interesting because people put thought into them in advance. And you quoted Rabbi Soloveitchik as a great line that there can be no kedusha, there can be no sanctity and holiness without hachana, without preparation. And it should be no different for the high holidays. And I'm really hoping, because, you know, we usually, you know, if we're unhappy or disappointed when we come out of the high holiday experience, it's usually the rabbi's fault. He didn't do a great job of the sermon, or the chazan didn't choose the right tunes, maybe. But I think we have to first look inside and say, what did we do to get to this place where we could really receive spiritually these beautiful ideas in the prayers and just the whole season? And just everything is different when you prepare.
So the preparation, I gather from your book, should fundamentally be as that for any new year we take seriously. Of course, the authentic Jewish New Year is Pesach. And that's why when we go into a Seder, you don't just go in, open the book and treat it like a dinner program. You have to...
Yeah, and that's why your book, Mark, people read it before Passover.
That was the goal, right?
If you show up at the Seder, even if you bring the, you know, your phenomenal book that you wrote, it's too late, man. You got to do it before. Come with a couple of snippets. The Seder is transformed when you have some insights.
Right. And you're saying it's basically the same thing for Rosh Hashanah. The same way you treat any new year is you have to take this existential inventory of yourself and then contemplate what resolutions and commitments will I make in the coming year. None of that is easy. None of that can be done quickly. And certainly it can't be done when you walk into a particular place on a particular day.
Yeah, 100%. And that's why I put a little challenge question after each entry.
Right.
Because what the challenge question does is it forces the reader to think about that teaching in relation to their own life. That's why it was designed to be like a little personal diary.
Right. Now, let's talk about some of the 40 different, basically, suggestions you have for how people can prepare and get themselves into existential shape for our confrontation with the Almighty on Yom Kippur. So let's talk about day 15, the psychology of gossip. Why is gossip and our relationship to it something that is crucial for how we prepare for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
So I think one of the reasons, I'm going to answer that question by answering another question, is why is it so enticing? Why is it so hard to stay away from speaking ill, or even it's not ill, just talking about other people? I have a quote.
Right, because you just made an important point in that the gossip that's forbidden in Judaism is not just speaking ill of somebody, it's speaking of somebody, with narrow and important exceptions.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody redid their kitchen, there's nothing wrong with somebody putting $100,000 into redoing their kitchen. We love to talk about that stuff. That's considered gossip. And I have a quote in the beginning from Eleanor Roosevelt: great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, small minds discuss people. Why do we talk about people so much? Why are we so drawn to it? There are it's a billion-dollar industry in this country about these different shows that focus on the lifestyles of the rich and famous. We love it because I think there are two ways to grow in your life. Either you can actualize your own personal potential, the potential that God gave all of us to live in an improved kind of way, or you can look around at other people and compare yourself with others. And when you compare yourself to someone that you think isn't doing so well, or you speak about them negatively, so they don't look like they're doing as well, it automatically makes us feel better about ourselves. I mean, think about, I remember I wasn't so great at math when I was younger, and I would sit there and I get, let's say, a 75 on a test. And I was like praying that the kid next to me would get a 74. Now, why does that make me feel bad? I still messed up. 75 is not a good grade. Why does his 74 make me feel better? It does, because I'm starting to estimate or gauge my own sense of self from the way I'm doing in relation to others, as opposed to the way I'm doing in relation to my own God-given potential. And that's the way I think gossip and speaking ill of others relates to our relationship with God. God created us. He knows our potential. And we're either living up to our own potential or we're not. And if we're not, we often look at others around us, compare ourselves, and then we can feel a little better. Not as bad as this guy. He didn't do so well either. But that's not really a demonstration of improvement. That's just me looking at others and comparing myself. It's a cheap way out.
Yeah, I think that was a brilliant insight you had in the second half of this chapter, which is when we gossip, we're fundamentally answering the question, am I inner focused or outer focused? So if I'm inner focused and I have confidence in myself and I have confidence in my relationship with God, then by definition, I'm not comparing myself against others and I will enjoy the success of others. But when we gossip, we're saying that's not who I am. And your point is brilliant here, is that we're actually rigging the game. Because when we gossip, we take the other guy down.
We're not really comparing ourselves fairly to other people. That's a great point. But you know the greatest biblical story that expresses this so profoundly, and that's when Moses was spoken by his own brother and sister, Aaron.
Exactly. He just prayed for her.
Yeah, he davened for her after she was stricken with leprosy. Why? Because he didn't get his sense of self from what other people said. I mean, he's such a great role model. And can you imagine if we're really feeling good about ourselves, irrespective of what other people thought about us, we would actually just do the right thing because it's the right thing. We wouldn't care what other people were saying.
With the other example of gossip is in Exodus 2:15, where the rumor got out that Moses had engaged in a fight and therefore he had to go into exile.
Yeah. He broke up the fight between the two Jewish people and they're like, hey, you were the one who killed that Egyptian dude, right? So you see spreading information completely changed his life. He had to go, he left for over 20 years, went to Midian.
Right. So let's turn to chapter 19, which I think is such an important wisdom here, particularly in this political and cultural climate. And the chapter is play the ball, not the person.
Yeah. So I came up with that phrase from my eighth grade basketball coach. He was trying to improve my defense. And he said, Mark, keep your eye on the ball, not the person. The person's trying to fake you out. But the ball is where you need to stay focused on. I kind of use that to talk a little about the way we argue with each other. And I think actually we're not arguing enough. I think what we've done in our society is basically cocooned ourselves with people with whom we agree. And we stop talking to people with whom we disagree because we don't like the way things develop, because it can get ugly. We have a different point of view. And the reason it gets ugly is because we start personalizing the debate. We start attributing ill will to the person we're speaking to. And in the Talmud, you have rabbis who vehemently disagree with each other over the most fundamental questions of human existence, both legally and philosophically. And they were friends, they were colleagues, and they played the ball, not the person, meaning they didn't personalize the argument. And we have to learn how to do that better. You know, instead of calling each other names and then, you know, attributing ill will because a person holds a certain view that's different from our own, we should be battling out the virtues of that view or the failings of that view and really arguing on the merits. I mean, we both went to law school. That's what we were taught to do in law school. That's how truth emerges, by a clash of ideas, the prosecution, the defense, the yin, the yang. And if we don't continue to have that and we continue just to, you know, defriend the people we don't agree with, or we cancel people that we think are doing things or saying things that are just immoral, and not really argue with people that we disagree with and try to get to some deeper truth, it's really pushing society back, I think.
That's right. It's so often it's a matter of hearing what a person says, caricaturing it by rephrasing it into something it's clearly not, calling the person a name that reflects what you just said he or she said, which is not what he or she said, and then inviting that to come back to you. And that's considered dialogue.
You wonder why we're not getting things done. I mean, that's the beauty of having a Republican and Democratic Party. That's the beauty of having liberals and conservatives. And that you saw that the example I give in the book is Hillel and Shammai.
Right.
Two adversaries argued over almost everything in the Talmud. The Talmud, whenever it records a debate, always says the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel.
Interesting, right.
It doesn't say Hillel and Shammai because they got along.
And didn't their kids marry each other?
These were great scholars, and you can have great scholars arguing and still being friends. We have not figured that out.
So how do you want someone 40 days before the high holidays approaching chapter 19? Let's use this as the example of preparation. So someone has only read chapter 19 of the book. How do they use that to enhance their high holiday experience?
I mean, I think the high holidays encompasses not only our relationship with God, but our fellow human being. I would suggest this is a good exercise to find someone that you disagree with. It could be on a political issue. I mean, nobody wants to talk about it, but it could be on a moral, ethical issue. And really, and say, you know what? I'd like to have a conversation with you about this. I want to know why you feel so strongly about, because I really have a very different view. And let's hash it out and let's see if we can actually stay friends when the conversation's over. We can go out and have a beer. And by the way, the end of the conversation might just be that the two of you still don't see eye to eye. That's okay. I just think if we can get more and more into that exercise, I'm tired of watching like on Fox or on CNN, they just keep inviting the same point of view. And it's just not interesting anymore. And it's not advancing the cause of our society. That's what politicians have to learn how to do in order to introduce new legislation that can actually help people reach across the aisle and figure out creative ways to compromise and to debate these issues. So, I mean, on a personal level, I wrote here as the question, how can you maintain polite and respectful dialogue with someone you disagree with? People are not dating anymore unless they fully agree with the other person politically.
So approaching the high holidays, though, do you want somebody who's reading this chapter to think about, in the past year, here are all the ways that I have played the person and not the ball, and then to make that call to that person with whom that dynamic may have happened? Like, how should it actually play out?
I mean, that's one scenario. I think that's one great scenario, because one of the purposes of the high holiday season is to do what's called tshuva, which is more of a returning to our true selves. I think that's the first thing, what you just said, Mark, which is repairing relationships that might have been bruised over the year. Now, some people, we just can't do it. Some people, we just have to agree to disagree and not get into the argument. It's not everybody can do it all the time. Sometimes the dynamic is too toxic. But if it isn't, I would start with that scenario. And I would try other individuals that we've become distanced from. Oh, I don't want to, you know, look at his views on this, look at her views on that. And then we become, little by little, we stop being friends with them. And we just don't have them on our Facebook feed. We don't engage in them. I would suggest calling up that person and saying, I want to go out to lunch with you. And I want to spend, and maybe you can even time it, because it can go on and on and on, and it can get like, we're not going to personalize it. We're going to talk about the actual issue over which we vehemently disagree. And let's see if we can still have a good, solid relationship. I would actually pick a few people. I would start with a scenario you described, someone there was a mess up in the past, and then some new ones of people that we see we've let those relationships go, but only if obviously you value and you want to have a connection with such a person.
Would another approach be to say to that person, I want a relationship with you irrespective of our significant disagreement. Therefore, let's get together but not talk about the ball? Let's focus on the things we have in common. Let's focus on the things we can do together. And if we argue over X, it's just going to make our relationship worse. And by the way, we know this with 100% certitude from modern psychology, from everything else. No one's going to convince anyone.
Right. So it's not really about convincing.
Right. It can't be.
And I agree with that. It can't be about convincing, because all the research shows, as you pointed out, that you're not going to really change a person's mind. Here's what's really important. Get the other person to see that your point of view has some validity.
Interesting. Right.
Even if they can, you know, I'll tell you, there was a great, I had a student many years ago, Vladimir Nyman. He was a PhD in mathematics from the University of Leningrad. He used to come to my beginner service every Shabbat. And I was 23, 24. He was at least in his 30s, brilliant mathematician. And I was doing the best I could to explain religion and science as best as I could understand. But I said, you know what? I want you to meet with my teacher. He's no longer alive, Rabbi Joseph Grunblatt, big scholar. And they got together. And the rabbi called me up and he said, Mark, you've done a wonderful job with Vladimir. I said, what do you mean? It was before MGE. He doesn't believe in anything. He doesn't believe in God. He only believes in what he can see, what you can prove in a laboratory. And he still doesn't believe in God. He says, why do you think I'm doing well with him? He says, because when I asked Vladimir, how has coming to Rabbi Wild's service been helpful? He said to me, before I came, I didn't believe in God, and I still don't believe in God. But before I came, I thought anyone who believed in God was a fool, opiate of the masses. It's a crutch. Now, I still don't believe in God, but now I believe that there are intelligent people who do.
That's an incredible story, revealing an amazing truth.
And, you know, I appreciate that. And my rabbi was like, listen, you're not going to convince everyone, but it bothers me that colleagues or atheists or agnostics would look at someone who believes as being a fool. Just like I don't look at a scientist who's an atheist. I understand they have a legit perspective. I disagree with it. But I think that they have what to base their opinions on, even if, you know, and I think if we can get to that place, I think that's a great point, Mark. I don't think the goal should be to convince. The goal is we don't have enough respect for people with opposing views. Conservatives are just losing respect for liberals. Liberals are losing respect for conservatives. And we're just throwing mud at each other. We got to get back to that place of respect.
Right. So the goal is not to convince, but to humanize.
Exactly.
And I think you're also right that the only way this happens is through a relationship. I've been fortunate to become very close with many Christian missionary doctors in Africa. And I remember I was talking with one of the doctors that we work with in Tanzania, been there for 30 years. And I said, at the end of 2 days with you, I said, I didn't see anything that I would have previously thought to be missionary activities, yet you're a missionary. He said, oh, you can't have those conversations unless one thing happens. I'm like, what's that thing? He said, unless the person says to you, why do you care so much? He said, only when someone says that can you begin to talk about what you would consider missionary things. It's all about a relationship.
Wow, that's powerful. That's really beautiful.
What you're saying, it's that a relationship opens these doors that would otherwise be closed.
Yeah, and that's what we need to have in life, to respect each other and to further the causes that we all believe are important. You know, and I don't want to get, you know, political, but I had the honor years ago. I interned for Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He was a great man. He was a liberal Democrat. He was the one who actually was the one to defeat the Zionism as racism bill that was in the United Nations, because he was the representative from the United States to the UN before he was a senator. He had serious relationships with conservative Republicans. And I used to see the two of them talk. There was a deep respect for one another. And they were like completely opposite aisles, but there was like a certain regard. And I feel like that's in the last 20, 30 years, I think that that's what we've lost. And we haven't just lost it with our politicians. We're losing it with our friends. So much so that somebody who I fix up, who's a little more conservative minded, can't go out with someone who's got a little more of a liberal stance on a certain point. That's ridiculous. Just see if we can have that respect and that humanism, like you just said.
Mark, thank you for such a fascinating conversation. Thank you for writing such a really remarkable book, which really should transform the way people approach the high holidays, because you've shown in the most profound way, by giving examples of how people can do it, that you don't go into the high holidays. You don't just walk in like you're walking into a preseason basketball game.
Preseason basketball game, you would probably, you know, prepare a little. I mean,
well, I said preseason because if you went to a regular season game, at least you'd pay attention to who was playing, what the standings were, what the record, you know, but these are the high holidays, and to take them with any of the seriousness they deserve, it requires preparation. When you put it in the book so clearly, it becomes so obvious. Of course it requires preparation. You provide the pathway to do it.
You know, you, Mark, I have to tell you, you inspired me a lot with the book you wrote about the Seder, because when I grew up, Passover, we shared with a lovely, lovely family. We're still close with them to this day. German Jewish family. We were with them in the Catskills. And the older gentleman, he's 96, okay? He's still alive. He's an amazing. He used to put me on the spot and he'd say, Mark, what do you think about this paragraph? I was like 7, 8 years old. But I was in.
That's great.
It was unbelievable. But then, like the first year, I just didn't know. I didn't know the answer.
Well, you're 7.
Yeah, but I prepared. I prepared. And that's what your book does. And that's what this is really designed to do for the high holidays.
Great.
So that we can get just much more out of it. That's all.
I believe that in reading your book and really thinking about the reason why you wrote it and your instruction on people to prepare, it really challenges a question I've asked rabbis, which is, and this is actually appropriate for you because you counsel so many young people who come from very secular backgrounds. If a young person said to you, I'm going to give Judaism 2 days a year, which two should I give it? And then and they say to you, don't tell me I should give more. I know that's what you're going to say, but I'm not listening.
Right.
What two do you say?
It wouldn't be Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, my friend. I'll tell you what it'd be. I would do, I mean, I don't know who decided in the United States that Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur should be, or it's really the Seder, you know, the most observed Jewish ritual in America is actually the Seder, which I would choose probably. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is amazing also, but it creates a certain perception of Judaism as a very somber shame, guilt. I did this wrong. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
That's the problem. If you're forced to choose two events, I can't really be one of them.
I go with Pesach and Shabbat or Pekos and Sukkot.
I would go with Shabbos or Pesach too, because I think Yom Kippur is incredibly important, but it doesn't bespeak enough of the general feel of Judaism.
You know, what you're saying is we have to prepare to get to Yom Kippur.
Yeah,
and exactly. we have to have that, the joy of Judaism and the love and the excitement and the enthusiasm. Yom Kippur gives us a lot of things. Doesn't give most of us that. Now, you point out in the book with your brilliant point about the Shekinah that it can, but that's after you really get into it.
100%. Like anything else, it takes a little work.
But you know, another answer to the question, which you really taught me from the book, is you could pick two holidays. I'll pick Pesach and Sukkot. Whatever you pick, prepare for.
100%.
So pick any two, but prepare for them, and then your experience will be massively enhanced, completely leveraged.
And going to the point you brought up before, he's like, you have to choose two. You don't want to like more. But the ethics of our fathers teaches that mitzvah gorerit mitzvah.
That's right.
When you do one mitzvah, it eggs you on to do another, if, like you say, you do it right.
Well, Mark, thank you for writing such a beautiful book. The book is called The 40-Day Challenge, Daily Jewish Insights to Prepare for the High Holidays. I have so many more questions, but we'll have to get together in person for them, because this book has aroused so many questions, so much thought. It's just an incredible work that I encourage everybody to read in preparation for the High Holidays, but it's really a book for the whole year.
It is. A lot of the themes here, you know, apply all year round as well, of course. Thank you. Mark, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Have a great day.
All right. Great seeing you. As with every conversation with Rabbi Mark Wilds, I learned so much. He's so instructive, so interesting, so profound, and he's given the gift of his wisdom to all of us in this truly magnificent book, The 40-Day Challenge, which I encourage everyone to read in preparation for the High Holidays next year in Graceland. I would like everyone who listened to this podcast and previous podcasts and, God willing, future podcasts to go to therabbishusband.com and to sponsor a surgery. These are surgeries of mothers and children in Africa whose lives you can transform or save by sponsoring a surgery that is all curated, all selected, all monitored, and all administered by African Mission Healthcare, which are Christian surgeons working in Christian hospitals, serving people of all kinds all throughout Africa. So go to therabbishusband.com, where you'll see a link to sponsor surgeries for those who need it most. And Erica and I are going to match every donation made up to $1 million. So just write in the subject line, The Rabbi's Husband, and God willing, let's save some lives together. I'm Mark Gerson, and this has been The Rabbi's Husband, and thank you for listening. Please go to Apple, to Spotify, to wherever you receive podcasts, rate, review, and subscribe. I can be found at therabbishusband.com or at The Rabbi's Husband on Facebook or Instagram, and I would love to hear from you, so please email me at mark@therabbishusband.com.